I think the biggest lesson I learned in the Roses was empowerment, because they've achieved something and they seem no different to yourself. And I learned that it's not just about music.
All right, welcome to my 90s music podcast, where I talk to the people who lived, loved, and were in the eye of the storm of the best decade ever, the glorious 90s. From Atlanta, Georgia, to Longsight, Manchester. Do you recognise that line? You should. It's from Daybreak by the Stone Roses from the Second Coming album. That line means so much to my next guest, who grew up in Longsight, Manchester, M13, on a council estate, dodged becoming a doctor against his parents' wishes, and became one of the most gifted guitarists and musicians and songwriters of his generation. Today, I have the real pleasure of chatting to one of the most positive and savvy people I've ever met, and that is Aziz Ibrahim. Aziz's energy was palpable even through the Zoom audio line, as he talked about how kids and technology are the future of music, and if you're going to be successful today, you have to learn this stuff and understand where the consumption of music is coming from. Aziz has a new single out called The Key of Three, so do check that out. You can hear it on Spotify, Apple Music, or your preferred music platform. And he's got a great line in cool merchandise called M13, that's the Longsight Manchester postcode, including t-shirts saying Longsight loves you and the funny one Johnny Kashmiri, and he's proudly wearing them on these sites. However, this is my 90s podcast, so we talked to Aziz about his days in Simply Red, prog rock band Asia, and what it was like to join the Stone Roses, filling the shoes as big as John Squire's, and then how Aziz got to be himself and unleash his true talent working on songs with Ian Brown for many of his solo albums, including Unfinished Monkey Business, all the way through to Solarized. We're going to talk a little bit about 80s, 90s and what happened there in terms of the Eye of the Storm and all the madness. And, you know, find out how you got to do what you do, and then move it into the now, really, and figure out, you know, what you're up to now, what's going on, and what's keeping you busy, and how people can hear more about you. So it'd be really great if we could just head back a bit. And, you know, I guess it was sort of late 80s. You were starting to, you know, appear in bands and things like that. It'd be really good to find out, you know, how that started, the love of guitar, all that stuff, and heading into, you know, obviously being part of the Stone Roses and Ian Brown's world as well.
Late 80s, I mean, I've always said this, that I didn't choose music. Music chose me. I was probably going to be a doctor or something, you know, that's where I was heading towards. I only played music for fun, but I was playing in so many groups, so many bands, and it wasn't session work. It was just like for fun, because, you know, mates would ask me to play in their band, and I kind of could play so many diverse styles. I got into, you know, like rockabilly bands, and got into reggae bands, and blues bands, rock bands, and jazz, and funk, and soul, and R&B, and hip-hop, everything. And in 1987, Simply Red's management rang me asking me if I wanted to join the band. And they were just beginning the world tour for Men and Women, second album. And I was like, you know, I was in early 20s and not a bean in my pocket. And somebody offers you like $1,000 a week. I was like, yeah, love the music. And I never heard any tracks, maybe one or two singles, and that's it. So began a future in music, not through my choice, but, well, I mean, I chose a path of that fate, you know, presented itself to me. But when you come straight off a council estate and somebody comes with that kind of money and that kind of, you know, opportunity, even as a Pakistani Muslim boy, you know, set on a path of this education and so forth, I went for it. I thought, why not? Why not diversify? I don't want to live up to the stereotype and become a doctor. So I decided to pursue that music kind of path.
And going into Simply Red then, I mean, was it you were part of the music creation as well at some point, you know, having to learn the songs, that pressure, and,
Not really. He wasn't that way. Mick wasn't that way. He definitely kept everything very close to himself. I think once we contributed, and that was like a track called Turn It Up, and we're on tours. I mean, all that year was 87, and some of 88 was taken up with just touring, world tour, country to country. I wasn't home for ages. And in sound checks just before shows, he'd come with an idea and we'd just go like join in because we'd jam it out and go, hey, Mick, what do you do like this? And we'd jam these ideas. And he'd go with the recording and next minute it was a track and we didn't get any royalties or, publishing or anything. But that was the only contribution. And so I took it for what it was, and it lasted how long it lasted before I realised it wasn't for me, session playing.
Yeah. And then what happened after that then? So the session played was sort of, not what you were into, and then...
Not really. I mean, it was kind of... I started to get offers from people, as in, would you drop some guitar on this? And it'd be like, singles for like PM Dawn or somebody, and I was like, wow, okay, yeah, I'll do that. And then MC Akala, well, I wasn't Akala, that was a co-write. There were sessions, but it kind of fizzled out. It wasn't for me. I realised that wasn't what I wanted to do. And then I kind of started working with artists like Ruby Turner and Errol Brown Hot Chocolate, and like being a musical director and helping put the band together and then touring with them. And then I joined a band again. I joined Asia, mm-hmm. the prog rock group Asia.
Yeah,
I mean, I've got a rock side of me, and it was just like, wow, this is fantastic. And I wrote music when I joined the band for an album called Asia Arena, but that didn't work out with that band and chemistry and, band politics.
Yeah.
And that brought me to basically down and out musician with no money. And I started teaching in like schools and primary schools and secondary schools and boarding schools and you name it, and colleges, make up the money. But it was wearing me out. I just couldn't take it anymore. And the Roses came along, 95. And that teaching thing ended there and then. I just couldn't keep the teaching up when I joined the Roses.
Yeah. And what's that happened then? I mean, obviously, Robbie Maddox was in at that point as well. And then, what?
And Nigel Lipinson as well, yeah. And you.
That's right, yeah.
Evo player, yeah.
Yeah. And then, what happened in terms of, going into that dynamic,
Strange dynamic. Initially... Robbie J had contacted me because they were demoing songs for let's call it the Third Coming. I like to call it the Third Coming.
Yeah.
And they were demoing the songs, and I think John was being elusive, or they just couldn't get hold of him. And Robbie had asked Ian and Manny whether it was cool to contact me about coming in to play guitar, just to help with the songwriting, so that they had a guitarist to play the songs that they were doing. So, songs like Black Sheep at that time and things like that were being written, and Ice Cold Cube, early version of Ice Cold Cube. And then there was another song as well. So I just played guitar and met Ian and I met Manny, and we'd gone great, just chatting. And I didn't realise my area, Longside, where I live on that council estate, it was in... Obviously, on the Second Coming album, lyrics.
Was it on Daybreak?
Yeah, from Atlanta, Georgia to Longside, Manchester.
Addis Ababa,
So it's just like fate again, There were certain coincidences, and I was kind of like, what's going to happen here? And then lo and behold, the call came back after they found out that John wasn't coming back. And the search for the guitarist was on. And they went through, various things. And it came full circle back to the kid from Longsight that maybe fitted the bill, the lineup, and there it began.
And what about the touring side of things and stuff? I mean, did you do a lot of shows with them?
Not a lot. I mean, bear in mind, it was kind of a secret that I'd joined the band. So we were into early gigs on festivals before Reading 96, so you know, we did that Benny Cassim and in Spain and Portugal, a festival in Portugal outside of Lisbon, I think, and then out to Denmark and playing, I think it was a Skanderborg festival. Mm-hmm. And then to Hungary, we did this festival in the middle of the Danube. There's a little island in the middle which we played. And then after that, we came back and we did Reading. They were the only Roses shows that we did together before implosion in 97.
Yeah. And what about learning the tracks, though? I mean, are you daunted by that stuff? Is it just fairly easy?
No, not at all. No. It took me about a week or so to learn the tunes by then. I'm so used to learning music from, you know, in the early days when I was 7 years old and I started playing guitar, and then I was teaching myself. And then the way I learned to play guitar was through the library, alongside library. I used to go there and they had a lending system. And they used to lend out vinyl and cassettes. So I just used to go and borrow vinyl and cassette of bands and music and go home, learn the music and bring it back. And that's how I learned to play, by ear, just listening to a record and keep rewinding stuff on the cassette. And I learned so many diverse styles so that when I joined groups, it was so easy to adapt. So the Roses was the same thing. I learned the music very quickly, but it's not that's difficult. It's the fact that you're stepping into the shoes of somebody who has a very unique and individual style and is much loved. So there's the difficulty there. You can't replace somebody with yourself. Yeah. The rejection you get from pro John Squire fans, you'll never be accepted because you're not him. And I understand that and I accept that. Secondly, it's a very unique style of an individual. So yeah, I can emulate other people. I could emulate anybody from Hendrix to the Squire to Santana to, you know, Tom Morello or something, you know, but you're not that person. You never will be. So for me, I never quite got that because John's John and I'm me. You know, I've got a very kind of Indian classical, not, it's almost like a South Asian way of playing guitar in a lot of ways. And I've got my own taste. So there was that clash there. And I was happy when it kind of ended in a way, because the role with Ian Brown meant I could be myself.
Yeah.
More so than I could be in the Roses, playing Roses tunes. And there's so many people better designed to do Roses tune, like in tribute and covers bands, that know the music and have the same equipment and would buy, you know, in an anorak fashion, would buy the same guitars and say. But I learned so much from it. At the end of the day, when I joined the Roses, I inherited the greatest guitars in the world. You know, I inherited a 1959 Gibson Les Paul, 59 Strat, 62 Strats, a hybrid Strat, another Les Paul beauty, actually, and a 59 ES-345. So, I mean, people who know guitars will go, what? Really? I mean, you know the value of those instruments. It's mind-blowing. And same with the amps. So I got taught something about owning, you know, some people would never in their lives actually experience vintage instruments like these, or even play them. And I did through the Roses and courtesy of John and courtesy of the band, you know, inherited this equipment and it changed me for life.
Yeah.
So,
but what about that kit then? I mean, so when you inherited it, what did a lot of the instruments belong to the band or the record label or something?
Yeah, when I say inherited, I mean as a member of the band, I was entitled to play these instruments, and some of them became mine. But obviously the things like the expensive ones, like the 59 Les Paul, that got sold on after the demise. And even during the Ian Brown era, I was still using it. It was a recorded Unfinished Monkey Business with that guitar. But it got sold, you know, tax reasons and so forth. It belonged to the band, and the band being obviously Manny and Ian, or whatever they agreed. I don't know. Those details, I'm not sure about financial details as to. I just went with the flow. You join a band, you know, you join the Roses and you get a big cash, bag of cash in used notes after playing Reading 96, and people go, right, we're buying a studio. And so you go with the flow, you know, you don't have a say. Kind of at the beginning, you know, it's when you establish yourself and become a contributor and something that you become a, you know, a spokesperson or a, you know, somebody who has a say.
Man, you're sounding like Chuck Berry. You know, he's a bag of cash. He always wanted his bag of cash before he went.
Yeah, off. Well, yeah. I mean, the Roses was like that. In all honesty, you know, I've never seen or have been in a band like that. And you know what I'm talking about. Really? And anyone who knows the Roses knows what I'm talking about. You know, and I was like a sober observer from the inside, looking out, watching the reaction of other bands, from your Travis's and Coldplay's to your Manics and your Whatnots and, you know, Shed Sevens, and you know the reaction of other bands. It's unbelievable, and even to this day, you know, and I kind of observed, I watched what was going on from the inside looking out, and you know, it was just unbelievable. The experience was unbelievable. From the press to the bands to the public, you know, to my dying days, you know, I'll never forget that experience, good or bad.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're sort of gods amongst men, I think, and untouchable, you know, just on a different frequency than...
Absolutely. I mean, the reaction from people is the difference. And the love and the hospitality, I was going to say hostility, a bit of both, maybe. But like when we come to Scotland or when we go to Ireland, we're like loved and in welcoming people's houses, and we'll knock around on like Easter House or somewhere, or in Belfast or something. We'll be in and out people's houses and partying from door to door. They were that loved, and not being an original member and not being a person who wrote the songs, but still being treated in that manner is just, it's next level. And I wouldn't exchange that for all the money in the world or whatever it is that, you know, you hold, you know, precious. I wouldn't exchange it. So that experience for life will live with me and make me smile.
Yeah. I mean, you know, being from the sort of Glasgow area and stuff, I mean, I think what they did, and it's a hard thing for a lot of people to get their head around, but you will, obviously, but they showed that you could do it, right? So, you know, I was not from a council estate, but not much above. And it's like, you know, you saw guys take on the world that were from a place like you were from, but just a guitar and writing some songs, and that gave you so much belief to just go and you could do it too.
Strength, confidence, independence, you know, belief, yeah, and inspiration. All these things come to mind that, you know, you're not necessarily, like you said, not necessarily off a council estate, but when you come from working class or you come from the kind of proletariat backgrounds, and, you know, you don't own the means of your income or things like that, you know, and you're empowered by things like this. And I think the biggest lesson I learned in the Roses was the fact that the word is empowerment. You know, you feel empowered when you're inspired by a group like that, because they've achieved something and they seem no different to yourself. They accept full of character and independence in that way, and they empower you. And I learned that it's not just about music, or music in this country is not just about music, and that's why it's so influential worldwide. You know, it's like you listen to the live shows, so just an example, and you come away criticizing maybe Ian or somebody like that, saying, oh, that was a terrible performance that night, but it's got nothing to do with that performance, has it? It's to do with that inspiration you get from people who will get up and do it, and the character and the personality, persona, and what they represent comes across more than the pitching of the voice. Do you get what I mean?
It's everything. It's the self-belief.
It's everything.
Around like a caged animal. It's
like Bob Dylan. His words and lyrics are more important than the tone of his voice.
It's just the soul that he's doing it with. I mean, I'll give you an example. I mean, I saw them at, just before you joined, actually, in 95 at the Barlands.
Yeah.
And it was two nights, and they kept the crowd waiting by 40 minutes. And the first thing was Breaking Into Heaven was the first song. Ian comes on, right? I'm getting shivers thinking about it. Come on. There was floodlit and ultraviolet light, and he come on with a full-length white parka. And it was like an apparition. It was just like... And everyone, I mean, there was grown men crying and hugging each other and kissing each other. Just, almost, they're bigger than your football team, you know?
And you
want them to do well, and you know. And
all a beautiful era, you know, that, I mean, prior to that as well, especially. With that experience. I mean, I've not been to a Roses show apart from Heaton Park when they relaunched. And I went, Zane had sent me a bunch of tickets for myself and my family. And said it would be great to see you. And, it was respectful to be there. But I'm not one for going to the shows, you know. I like to stay out the way because, you know, I had a great time. And, you know, I'm thankful and grateful for it, but I've moved on. So I just keep out of the way. You know, there's so many things that go with it, the entourage that goes with it. But that era, that experience, you know, I didn't experience things like that because obviously I'm on the stage and I'm seeing the other side of it. But I never experienced, obviously not being an original member, what it was like at that time, for instance, like you just said, from the punter's point of view as to what they experienced. But I understand, I've seen it in people's eyes and I fully get it.
So obviously then, you know, the Roses side of things and then Reading happened and all that stuff. But then you got to shed that skin and be a bit more you going into the new Ian Brown albums, the solo efforts?
Oh, yeah, definitely all me. You know, not just a bit. It was a case of, you know, songwriting freedom. Because, I know what the press kicked out in 97 and 98, but I will tell you, because I was there throughout the whole process and was one of the people, one of the only people involved in that initial process with Ian. Because the Roses had ended, nobody was around. People were falling out or gone silent or gone underground. So I'd been round to Ian's house. I thought he's the only person who's I can contact that. I know he'll probably tell me what's going down. And when I went out to the house and when he lived in Warrington, in Lynn, in Cheshire. And he was at home, you know, doing his garden, growing and cultivated a beard. And he told me what the crack was. And I was like, right, okay. And I felt at ease because I knew what had gone down. I accepted the situation, but we got talking, and then I started messing around on the guitar, and I was playing Corpses, or the beginning of Corpses in Their Mouths. And he went, "What's that? That's great." That got a fag packet out, ripped it up, and started writing some lyrics. Great. So, and that was the beginning of him deciding. Oh, right. Actually, I think he'd already decided he wanted to do a solo album, but when the time was right. But this instigated the writing, or more writing, or the writing that he wanted to do. And then we proceeded from there, and so it grew. And I had that freedom to do whatever I wanted to do, to play. And I felt inspired because he liked the tunes. And I was like going on thinking, what else have I got? And then I wrote My Star, or the music for. Yeah. And recorded it at home and came back with this epic kind of thing. And he was like, whoa. And then just wrote some epic lyrics. And next minute, see, these tunes just went on and on like that. And then we were short of tunes. And he decided to dig in deep and got some of those old Roses demos, like Ice Cold Cube. And Na Na as well. That's the tune, yeah. And then I looked at Ice Cold Cube and went, there were issues, and there were legal issues, and there was wranglings about who owned what. And I didn't start. I just took that tune and I just said, let me revamp the tune. And I did it in a kind of a Beatles kind of way, Ice Cold Cube, and I changed it up. And Ian and I played bass on it and passed the bass between us. So you see this kind of, there was a closeness about the recording of that, which was happening in my house in Longsight M13 or in his house in Lynn. And this album came together, and we used stuff to fill the album with old Roses material as well. But that was it, really. We just created this album together and then picked a studio, Chiswick Reach, to go into. And then we went to The Forge in Oswestry after that. So you know, and the press wrote something about, oh, you know, I did this album and so many people contributed. It wasn't like that at all. It was two guys working on an album in the small bedroom of a semi-house or detached or whatever in Lyme, and my place in my little bedroom, just writing from my home with the little bit of gear I had in a little port studio. And we formulated this thing, and he was prolific and writing, and he was inspired, and I just kept feeding music. And then he was writing music, and he, you know, he playing bass and programming drum machine and keyboards. And then we brought people in to do things, you know, like the late Denise Johnson, you know, passed away recently. One of my oldest and closest friends. She, you know, we brought her in to do vocals on Lions, and then we discovered Simon Moore, and Simon played drums on some stuff, and I was playing a bit of drums in the programming, but we got him in. And you know, then Inda Goldfinger came in later on when we, but that was after, because we'd completed the album, and we were thinking about putting a band together and putting our heads together about who should play what.
I mean, with Denise, you know, God rest her, we'd I'd get a wee radio show on a Sunday night, did a wee tribute to her last night, and
great.
Massive shock, and I think, you know, just
devastated
the soul of you know, Acid House, great tracks beyond that, you know, and you know, listening back, and you know, we listened to Lions as well lately, and just stunning stuff, you know, and you know, to have some time, to have spent some time with her, you know, I mean, what a blessing, what a gift, you know.
Such a shame, you know, and I won't dwell on Primal Scream, ACR, and Ian Brown. You know, she was a talent, unbelievable talent in her own right. You know, she was on, in the early days, Denise and I were in the same band called A Fifth of Heaven. Mm-hmm. And we had a club hit. It was like a cult kind of status hit called Just a Little More. And this was just before I joined Simply Red. So, you know, it was around that time. And then she joined the Primals when I joined Simply Red. So we had quite a parallel kind of relationship success story. But we're best friends from then. So she was, and she'd done many records, you know, Michael Hutchinson album, and she worked with P.P. Arnold, obviously, and George Clinton, and so many people. But she was like the Chaka Khan of the United Kingdom. She was just such a fantastic voice, a great writer. I remember a time when I came back from Simply Red, I had a bit of money, and it was a birthday, and I bought a four-track cassette port studio, which had like a shoulder strap on it. He just carried it out in like a little handbag, and it was a four-track port studio. I said, here you go, Denise, because you need to write your own material, and you can, and you're a great writer and music, but learn the technology as well. Learn to, you know, do your own technology and engineering and production, because it always gets dominated by men. And I said, you can do it all yourself. I know you well. And that's how she was. She's a very independent person, very talented, not your, you know, hire and fire kind of person. She was a singer, songwriter, musician, engineer, producer. And not a lot of people know that, because they only see that thing about, you know, I've got to say, you know, it's like white indie music scene. It's dominated by men. And she was her own person, very talented, such a loss. And also, it's a shame as well that what we've seen out there about the press misspelling a name and getting her age wrong, and putting the picture of Mary, I've forgotten, is it Mary, the other lady that sang with Primals after she left? There was another black woman that sang with them, and having her picture put up instead of hers, Pierce, I think it was. And just the plagiarism and the typos and the such disrespect during Black Lives Matter, during this awareness of Black Lives Matter. It's unbelievable and makes me so angry, but it's sad. There's nothing you can do about it, you know. Forget them people, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm, you know, excited to, I think it'll be a nice moment to go and get the new album when it's released and have a moment to,
absolutely, yeah. You should live through the music, as artists often say. You know that. You know, when I've gone, listen to my music. So
yeah, that'll be good.
So remember them that way.
So what sort of happened as that was wrapping up, and you know, what are you sort of spending your time on now and your focus on now?
I'm still watching Still Game and Chewing the Fat, so I can understand what you're saying. apart from that, so I've just released my new single for a start. Lockdown really, you know, has kind of put me into this mode of trying to, well, actually get my ass off, well, ass on a seat, actually, not the other way around, writing music, being prolific, learning from YouTubers and gamers about monetizing online, going digital, and getting content out there, sharing music and stuff that has been in my lockers and archives, and sharing it with other people so that they can hear it and if they want to. So that's where I'm at the moment, starting my own label, Indus Records. Like my new single, The Key of Three, is on Spotify and the usual things, that downloads for iTunes and Amazon and whatnot.
what are you thinking about all that? You know, because, you know, Daniel X, I think his name is it? He, from Spotify, he came out and started telling, you know, musicians when to release, how to release, you know, what... There's a lot of musicians against it. How are you feeling about all the sites and stuff?
Yeah, of course, there's all I can say is there is always something wrong with anything. It's like banking or something. You know, there's always something wrong, and the government laws have to be changed, and rules should have to be changed. Things get amended, but there's no point in waiting. Get that stuff out. You know, people, musicians have been ripped off since day one. They were ripped off badly by record labels and publishing and management to the figures of millions and millions, you know, and we were getting pennies, fractions of pennies then, you know, in terms of our royalties and what we got in the contracts we signed. And look at the roses, you know, things are bad anyway. So it's still, yeah, you're right. In the digital world, there are things that are not right, but just get on with it. We've got to be prolific and pour out music, and it's, as well as the cons, there are pros, and I find the pros far outweigh the cons. And it's just that there's been an industrial revolution, it's a digital revolution, and you can learn from young people how they've embraced digital technology. It might not be the music you're into or the platforms that they use that you're into, but you can certainly learn from them to restructure yourself to earn an income. And I'm not saying that I'm earning an income from it, but I'm saying that I'm putting out and being proactive and making music. And that's the main thing, is that you make content and then things will fall into place, and you'll find that, you know, you can monetize in different ways. There are so many different channels. It's just not where you think the money is. It's in a different place now, and you have to adapt or not. It's your choice. There are so many channels, and you can monetize them in different ways and offer products that you can own 100%. You've got that control. It's no longer the majors and so forth can dictate to you. You just got to learn a bit more and be more hands-on with your publishing or with your copyright or about selling or about marketing or advertising or promotion. You got to take an interest in those things. And DIY doesn't mean just be amateur about it. DIY means that learn some new skill sets and get active, get proactive about it. And you can turn things around. I've started a merchandise business of my own, you know, t-shirts. I've got a brand called M13, obviously for my postcode, alongside M13, and I want to give back to the area I'm from. So I started my own brand M13, and I've got slogan t-shirts of the albums and the music and my name, or just ideas I can't come up with, like Johnny Kashmiri. You know, I'll twist a name around Johnny Cash to Johnny Kashmiri, alongside Loves Your t-shirts. And so I've got my merch business going, and I don't know, I waffled a lot then, but I hope you get the idea of what I'm saying.
I totally do. I mean, that's my life outside of doing this. I mean, that's what I do. You know, I do brand marketing, digital social, and I think...
Yeah, and podcasting. You know, podcasting is very important, and you can be monetized. I think you've just got to do it for yourself. You really got to DIY, but do it in a way that actually earns you an income. And watch YouTubers, watch gamers, see how they are creating income from creating content and podcasters are creating content that people actually want.
Yeah.
And finding like-minded people around the world, not just in just regionally.
Yeah. No, I think it's a really smart spot. So obviously with all your thing, you know, M30 merchandise, you know,
the new single, The Key of Three. Yeah, I'll give that a plug. Yeah.
At your preferred platform or go and buy it. And social digital, how to follow you and your label name and everything. Then
I'm on across all social media in general. You know, I've set up pages and all the Ian Brown stuff, the Monkey Business kind of heritage legacy, all that's on Monkey Business as it's an Indie Channels. So it's all separated, you know, and my solo stuff is on my own Aziz Ibrahim Music or aziz.co.uk, those kind of channels.
Yeah. Well, we'll get all that in the podcast notes for you and make sure we're shouting it loud because, you know, it's great.
Appreciated. Support is always appreciated. Thank you.
So just before you go, Aziz, there was a couple of quick fire, just 90s questions that I'm doing at every show.
Try
and get a bit of fun at the end. So
I'm rubbish at them things, but I'm in for a penny, in for a pound. Here we go.
So best song of the 90s.
Best song of the 90s. Oh, right. There you are. 90s. Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Nice. Best album of the 90s.
Well, then in that which case, never mind.
you might be going for the hat trick here then. Apart from the bands you were in, who is the best band of the 90s?
There you go. Hat trick.
And then...
Nirvana. It's got to be Nirvana, hasn't it?
Ah, incredible. Best gig that you went to as a punter?
Oh, gosh. That is so difficult. Best gig I went to was... I really don't know. Quick fire, you said, eh? I'll tell you what. Yeah, when I was a kid, I went for one of the best gigs I went to was Rush. And that was at the Apollo in Manchester. I was a big prog rock fan and I was into Rush and they'd come, and it was during Permanent Waves, I think, and they came to Manchester Apollo. Superb. It just blew my mind. I wanted to play the guitar.
Nice. And then best gig that you've ever played?
Me? Well, that's a toss-up between the big gig, which would be Simply Red, San Paolo Football Stadium. Oh. In the middle of the night, sun, you know, in the heat and the warmth, surrounded by 150,000 beautiful people. That was mind-blowing, thinking I wish my mum and dad were here. And the best gig, per se, was probably like the Spinning Top, which is a little pub in Stockport. And just trying my ideas out and things like that, and people's kind of honest reactions and talking to them afterwards, it's got to be the other one, yeah.
favorite venue? Well, you talked about the bars, but is that your favorite venue in the world?
In the world, I mean, there again, you see, you get these big venues. My favorite venue could be the San Paolo Football Stadium, but right. I think, yeah, Barrowlands is definitely there as one of my favorite venues of all time. Just, I think it's more to do with the atmosphere than anything.
Nice. All right. Well, listen, Mister, I'll let you go. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. And
hey, no worries, a pleasure, mate. I always enjoy sharing this stuff. Sometimes new things come out, don't they? You know, yeah. That I've not mentioned before.
Well, sounds like you've got a future in digital. You can give Zuckerberg a run for his money.
I'm going to give it a go. I'm going to give it a go. That's all you can do at the end of the day, in your place you can't, you know, put your money where your mouth is and all that kind of thing.
Oh, you're saying the right thing and inspiring musicians to hopefully think about things in a different way as well to try and help.
Well, I'm inspired by musicians. I'm inspired by, you know, people who are doing it. It's not just me. I'm motivated by other people out there, young people doing stuff and the way they're handling the situation and people out there's love for music and support. So it's kind of supporting each other in a sense. That's how we get, I think, how we'll get through it.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Okay, well, on that positive note, I'll let you go.
And cheers, bro.
Yeah, hopefully we'll bump into you in real life soon at some point.
I hope so. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Aziz. Take care, man.
What a joy to talk to Aziz Ibrahim about his 90s experience. Do follow Aziz on @AzizIbrahim56 and at MB Aziz and Inder on Twitter to see what he's up to. And also, please do check out his new single, The Key of Three, and his clothing label, M13. And you can find that at www.wornfree.com. That's www.wornfree.com. Thanks so much for listening to this episode. I hope that it filled you with as much joy, nostalgia, and happiness that it did for me. Please do share this podcast with your 90s obsessed pals and follow me on at My 90s Music Podcast on Facebook and Instagram and at My 90s Music Pod on Twitter. Lastly, please do go to Mixcloud to hear my 90s based radio show, including an Ebworth special. Just search Supersonic 90s Radio Show on Mixcloud and you'll find it there. Until next time, keep it 90s, over and out.